skilled in the art of stagecraft. Putty noses, horsehair wigs, and phony accents were his bread and butter, so to speak. He would have leaped at the chance to transform three clever, well-mannered, if occasionally wolfish, children into the horrible, incorrigible babushka-woos. Luckily, the children had superb imaginations. They simply asked each other,
"What would Simon Harley Dickinson do?"
Soon they had scores of ideas. Alexander and Beowulf each blackened an eye with candle soot, for they knew Boris and Constantin fought like two cats in a bag, as the saying goes, and often sported such bruises. They slicked back their hair with pomade and put on matching outfits, thus giving the impression of being twins. Lastly, they obtained a pair of tattered men's gloves from Jasper, one of the young manservants of the household staff, who had always been a good friend to them. He was a particular favourite of the Margarets, too. Her distinctive, high-pitched voice trilled like a skylark when he was nearby. They each tucked a single glove beneath the belts they had cinched round their waists. That it was only one did not matter. Their gloves were not for wearing, but for challenging people to duels at the slightest provocation, or for no reason at all. Meanwhile, Cassiopeia found a length of pink tulle in Madame Lepont's trunk of fabric scraps, left over from a petticoat made from one of Lady Constance's gowns. This she fashioned into a ballerina's tutu. A pair of socks with bows stitched on top served nicely as ballet slippers.
"What is important,"
Alexander said, when the costumes were complete,
"even more important than the clothes, the most important part of our disguise, is that we are horrible, in the words of Agatha Swanavoo. If you wish to be convincing, first you must be convinced."
Primming with confidence, the horrible incorrigibles made their incognito exit, thus narrowly missing the fishy arrival of Edward Ashton and the even fishier return of Master Gogolev and his herring. Note that fishy can mean both suspicious and smelling like fish. Carp is a type of fish. Carp also means to complain. Flounder is a type of fish. It also means to be hopelessly confused. And sole, as you may know, is yet another type of fish. Sole also means the only one, as well as the bottom of the foot. If sole were the sole type of fish whose name had multiple meanings, that would be one thing to carp about, but three is enough to make anyone flounder. A fishy business, indeed. Even as their nemesis prowled the nursery, the horrible incorrigibles whined, punched, duelled, and pirouetted all the way to the bakehouse. All that bad behaviour was exhausting, and they had made frequent stops to rest. They did this by sitting and pouting, having lying down tantrums and giving each other the silent treatment. No one recognised them, and they felt proud of their disguises. Then again, it was midday, and all the household staff were hard at work. The only person who actually saw the children was old Timothy. He came across them as they lay belly down on the ground, pounding their hands and feet against the earth and blaming each other for their misery. One of the coachman's eyebrows flew up as the other scrunched down, but he simply walked on, chuckling. Eventually, the children reached the bakehouse, a stone cottage that housed a massive brick oven with a double-width chimney. When the oven was in use, the bakehouse grew hot as a sauna, and they pushed the door open with caution. But there was no fire lit. Along one wall was a wooden trough for mixing the dough and metal buckets for adding water to the flour. Tall iron baker's racks held the rising loaves on one side and finished loaves on the other. Wooden paddles had been propped next to the oven, ready to slide the loaves in and out. Nowadays you might see something similar in a pizza restaurant, although you can be sure that the incorrigibles had never set foot in such an establishment. The bakehouse smelled deliciously of bread. All that was missing was the baker,
"Yoo-hoo!" the children called, cupping their hands to their mouths. "Yoo-hoo! Baker!" As they waited for an answer, they continued to complain and pick fights with each other. They planned to stay incognito until they knew for certain that the new baker was their old friend, the spooky Madame. But there was no one in the bakehouse at all, as far as they could tell. Surely the bread was not baking itself. After a brief discussion, they decided to make eerie ghosty noises. These would be likely to intrigue the soothsayer and lure her out of hiding if she happened to be in earshot. "Boo!" they intoned. "Boo-boo-ow!" Bang! A cloud of ash billowed from the oven. The incorrigibles jumped back as a tall, slim figure, bloodless and grey as some awful spectre from beyond the veil, emerged from the chimney itself. "Ah!" the children screamed, for it truly looked like a ghost. "Ah!" the figure screamed in return, for he was just as taken aback as they were. Despite her lack of proper point shoes, Cassiopeia rose effortlessly in her toes out of sheer terror. Alexander and Beowulf shakily threw down their gloves.
"I challenge you to a duel, you oven monster!"
Alexander yelled to cover his trembling voice.
"Me too, you smoky ghosty!"
Beowulf added. The boys raised their fists and tried to look fierce. The apparition loomed before them, pale as the moon.
"Say," the monster said, "if I didn't know better, I'd swear you were those three horrible Russian children I once met in Brighton. But that's not possible, is it? I must be dreaming. Or maybe I got some cinders in my eye while I was up there in the chimney. Hold on a minute."
The monster rummaged through his pockets and procured a filthy handkerchief. He rubbed his eyes and face and looked at the children again. This time he broke into a wide smile. The teeth behind his ash-grey lips gleamed white as a crisp new sail.
"Well, I'll be. I almost didn't recognize you. Cassia Wolf, in that nifty dancing outfit. And look at you, two fine fellows, with your hair all slicked back. Shows what I know about fashion."
"Simon!" the no longer horrible incorrigibles yelled and ran to hug him, filthy as he was.
"Simon Harley Dickinson!"
Once Simon had stripped off the work coveralls he had worn over his clothes and washed his face and hands with clean water from the pump out back, he looked nearly himself again, only his hair was left silver with ash.
"It would be a fine bit of stagecraft if I'm ever called upon to play my own grandfather," he joked. "Then again, Grandpap's life has been dull and contented as a frog's on a rock. Good lives make bad plays, as they say, but all that peace and quiet surely helps the digestion. So, incorrigibles, we meet again. I'm glad of it. Any news from our Miss Lumley?"
The children's expressions of joy faded and they shook their heads. Simon chewed his lip.
"That's too bad. I haven't heard a peep from her either, and I've sent a letter just about every day."
He was quiet for a moment, then shrugged off his mood with ease, the way one might shrug off a coat upon coming indoors. With an open smile, he reached out and tousled the children's heads till they too were cheerful again.
"Well, I suppose you're wondering what I'm doing here."
The children spoke at once.
"New baker, Madame Ionesco. Gypsy cakes."
"Nothing gets by you three, does it?"
he replied, laughing. He leaned close and dropped his voice.
"You're not wrong about any of it, but mum's the word. The good Madame is in disguise. Here in the bakehouse, we can speak freely. There's no one near, and the walls are solid stone. But outside this room, she's Flora the Bread Lady, understood?"
The children nodded.
"We are in disguise too," Alexander explained, "as the horrible, incorrigible babushkawoos."
Simon grinned. "That's a relief. For a minute there, I really thought I was seeing things. But why the secrecy?" His tone changed to one of concern.
"Say, is anyone following you? Making threats? Causing trouble?"
"We are incognito as babushkawoos because we thought Madame Ionesco was incognito as a baker.
Cassiopeia explained.
A regular incognito party, eh? I expect you didn't want to risk giving her away by being yourselves when she was being someone else. The children nodded, and Simon grinned. Clever as always. Anyway, I bet being horrible is fun, and a lot of work, too. With this, the children could not argue.
But why are you here, Cimmerwool?
Beowulf asked, which prompted a jumble of questions.
What were you doing in the oven? Why is Madame baking instead of soothsaying? How many gypsy cakes would go into the tummy of an incorrigible?
And so on, until Simon raised a hand for silence. To explain all that is a tale, all right. It's not a long tale, but a medium one. Say, that's not bad. A medium tale about a soothsayer. The children groaned to show their appreciation for the pun, for they knew that medium was another word for soothsayer, and that a soothsayer, who was halfway between large and small, could fairly be called a medium-medium. Once they were done groaning, they begged Simon to tell his tale. Ever the showman, he quickly arranged three upside-down buckets as stools for the children to sit upon, like a proper audience. To begin with, since the last time I saw you three, I've done nothing but eat, sleep, and look for Madame Ionesco. It's what our dear Miss Lumley asked me to do, for reasons that are what you might call urgent.
What reasons?
Cassiopeia asked innocently. Simon looked uncomfortable. Oh, nothing we need to go into right now, as I was saying.
Does it have to do with the curse upon the Ashtons?
She interjected.
The one that says only one side the family can survive?
Beowulf asked.
Or else both will go extinct, like the dodos.
Whereupon Alexander mimed the death of the very last dodo, and a tragic, squawking death it was. Apparently the children had understood far more about the family's troubles than the adults in their lives imagined they did. Simon tugged at his forelock, releasing a small cloud of ash.
Well, as a matter of fact, it does. But don't you three be worrying yourself about curses and whatnot. Let's just say that finding the good Madame was important. Anyway, I searched for the old gypsy all over London, at all of her usual haunts. Haunts. Get it?
Agreeably, the children groaned at his clever use of the word haunts. Simon grinned and grabbed one of the wooden baking paddles, which he proceeded to ride like a hobby horse round the bakehouse.
I checked the occult bookstores, the spooky carnivals, the abandoned cemeteries, and all the obscure and little-trafficked corners of the city. Nothing.
He dismounted, breathless.
Panic set in. As I said, I'd promised Miss Lumley some answers that only Madame Ionesco could give, and I wasn't making any progress. I even worried that our dear Penny might be cross with me about it, and perhaps that's why she wasn't answering my letters.
The children's eyes grew wide and sad.
Well, never mind that, Simon quickly went on. Imagine it. Day after day, I search for the soothsayer. At night, I sleep backstage at whatever theatre has left the stage door unlocked. If you don't mind a firm surface, a pile of sandbags can make a decent mattress, you'll be pleased to know.
But what about Madame Gypsy Cake?
The children begged.
I'm nearly there, mates.
His voice took on a mysterious tone.
About a week ago, with the moon only one night short of full, I'm pushing a janitor's broom across the stage of the Royal Piccadilly in exchange for a meal.
Now the wooden paddle stood in for the broom.
When I hear a ghostly voice calling from the back of the theatre. Simon, it moans, eerie as can be. Simon Harley Dickinson.
He paused for effect, and indeed, the children were on tenterhooks.
Well, I know how to pick up a cue when I hear one, he continued. I drop my broom, take a deep breath, and answer back. Angels and ministers of grace, defend us!
Shakespeare,
the children cried.
You bet it is, Simon struck a theatrical pose. It's what Hamlet says when the ghost of his kingly dad turns up at the castle at Elsinore. I know the speech by heart and would have been keen to play it too. But before I can spit out another forsooth, the mysterious Madame herself waddles down the aisle and plants herself at the footlights. "Madame Ionesco, where on earth have you been?" says I. She smirks as if I'd asked the wrong question. "Never mind where," she says. "Now listen. A message has come to me from beyond the veil. We must go to the rich man's house, quick. Call us a cab, would you, honey?" He paused. By the rich man's house, she meant Ashton Place, in case you had any doubts.
"But what was the message?"
Beowulf asked, enthralled to the story. Simon shrugged.
"You'll have to ask Madame Ionesco. Whatever she saw in her orb of prognostication, so far she's kept it to herself. Anyway, aye, aye, madam," I reply. I dash out of the theatre to find us a hansom cab, and to whom should I bump smack into but the enigmatic coachman himself.
"Oh, Timothy!"
the children yelled. "Correct. His carriage was parked right outside the stage door of the Royal Piccadilly. What were the odds of that happening, I ask you? But no, don't answer, for the children had already begun to figure it out. As I expect that even the laws of mathematics are not up to the task of explaining old Tim," the children concurred. After my shock wears off, and we exchange brief pleasantries, I ask if we can hitch a ride back to Ashton Place. "Only if you can bake," he says. "I can't go home without a baker, or Mrs. Clark'll have my hide." To prove his point, he gives me this very copy of the Ashton Weekly Gazette, in which a curious advertisement appears, as you may say, for yourselves. Simon produced the newspaper to show the children as he recited from memory. "Excellent bread baker needed. Experience with angry mobs preferred. Well, I've faced the matinee crowds on the West End and lived to tell about it, but I'm all thumbs in the kitchen. On the other hand, nothing fazes Madame Ionesco, and she's as good a baker as she is a prognosticator."
"Gypsy cakes!"
the incorrigibles rubbed their tummies and swooned. "It's her speciality, and a fine one too," Simon agreed. "Old Tim," I say, "it seems we're both in luck. We need a ride, and you need a baker." Off we went. Along the way, the coachman suggests we'd be wise to travel incognito. I ask why, and he answers, "Because I said so. Suspend your disbelief, lad, and just do it." That's how Flora the Bread Lady was born. One loaf, and she was a shoo-in for the baker's job, though I suspect she may have knocked out the competition with some hocus-pocus too, if rumours are to be believed.
"And you found a job? As a chimney climber?"
Alexander asked, puzzled.
"Oven elf?"
Beowulf guessed.
"Smoke inspector?"
That was Cassiopeia's theory. "Nothing so fancy. I was just trying to fix the flue. It was stuck." Simon's tale was done. He put the wooden paddle back in its place. "I haven't found a job yet. We thespians don't have much experience with honest employment. I'm not sure where to begin."
"You could be Shakespeare," Alexander suggested. "The Bard of Ashton Place,"
Beowulf said, trying out the title.
"Ashton's Thespians Deluxe,"
Cassiopeia crowed. She and Beowulf acted out a brief sword fight in which they both met gruesome ends, much like the conclusion of Hamlet. They ended up sprawled on the bakehouse floor, a tragic tangle of limbs. Simon reached out both hands and helped them up. "Some day, perhaps, but pretending to be a bard is not much of a disguise, since I already am one, and Shakespeare's long dead. I'd only draw attention if he turned up at Ashton Place." Alexander frowned, thinking.
"You need a job that is incognito. More incognito than Shakespeare,"
Beowulf said.
"You need the most incognito job there is,"
Cassiopeia declared. But what job would that be? It would have to suit Simon's talents and temperament, while also allowing him to be completely unrecognizable. The incorrigibles furrowed their brows and stroked their chins. Idly, Beowulf picked up the newspaper Simon had handed them earlier. Together, the children perused the pages. Simon poked at the rising bread loaves in frustration. "Frankly, I'm stumped. If only there was a job opening for a household navigator. That would work. Or I settle being the Ashton astronomer. I know a thing or two about the constellations. I'd call myself Starry Sam, the Milky Way Man, or something of that ilk.
His voice trailed off. A troika of incorrigibles looked up at him. Six wide eyes gleamed with insight.
What? Simon asked, suddenly uneasy. You don't like Starry Sam?
Simmerwoo,
Cassiopeia said, as her brothers giggled helplessly.
We know the perfect job for you.
The applicant for the job of baby nurse folded her large gloved hands in the lap of her brightly floral patterned dress. She was tall and perched with difficulty on one of the delicate antique side chairs in the front parlour of Ashton Place.
My name is Mrs. Penworthy, she said in a deep contralto voice. Mrs. Elsinore Penworthy.
The lady smiled primly and scratched under the edge of her bonnet. The bonnet covered all her hair except for two short lengths that stuck out at each ear. It was not what one would call an elegant hairdo. It had a bit of a horsetail look about it, to be frank. Her dress was ill-fitting, snug across the shoulders and loose around the middle. However, the colourful meadow flower print of the fabric and the shocking flounce of pink tulle that had been unevenly stitched round the hem surely lent the garment a festive air.
Penworthy, eh? Write that down, incorrigibles.
Lord Frederick chewed aggressively on his unlit cigar. Unlike Mrs. Clark's advertisement for the baker, the advertisement Lord Frederick had placed for a baby nurse in the Ashton Weekly Gazette had made no mention of angry mobs. Consequently, the household had been flooded with applicants. They formed a long line at the door of Ashton Place that stretched the full length of the curved driveway, past the formal gardens and the blooming daffodils, and onto the grassy lawn. Such a quantity of prospective baby nurses made Lady Constance throw up her hands.
Look at them all! They keep coming, like ants at a picnic. I want nothing to do with it, if you please,
she exclaimed, and waddled off to inspect her tulip garden once more. This left Lord Frederick in charge, though he was quick to admit he felt out of his depth. Mrs. Clark convinced him to let the incorrigible children assist, as they were still quite young and were bound to have more insight into what a baby might like than an older person would. Alexander had the neatest handwriting and took notes on each applicant, while Beowulf and Cassiopeia escorted the ladies in and out of the parlour. So far, there had been a wide range, from energetic young girls to calm, silver-haired ladies with long letters of reference. Most of them seemed perfectly nice, yet, curiously, the incorrigible children had objected to them all.
"Smells like cheese,"
was but one example of the many disqualifying flaws they discovered.
"Froggish voice, dangerously thin ankles, failure to smile. Too much smiling."
These reasons and more were given by the incorrigibles to rule out one candidate after another. By now, Lord Frederick was crabby and tired, and he had nearly given up on ever finding someone suitable.
"All right, Mrs. Penworthy," Lord Frederick said, feigning interest. "You've some experience taking care of babies, I expect. Heaven knows I don't. Yes, ahem. I mean, yes, my lord," Mrs. Penworthy's voice cracked like a teenaged boy's. "I do love babies, so. Why, just last week I was tending the sweetest little cherub you can imagine. All dimples and velvety skin and cute little burby-werpies." "But not every child is sweet," Lord Frederick scowled. "What if the rascal's a bit wild now and then? Noisy and destructive, like a young pup, what? How would you feel about that?"
Before she could answer, Alexander loudly cleared his throat. The incorrigibles positioned themselves behind Lord Frederick's chair so they could only be seen by Mrs. Penworthy. They bared their teeth into wolfish expressions, swiped at each other with pretend claws, made O-shaped howling mouths as if baying at the moon and so on. Mrs. Penworthy's eyes never left Lord Frederick.
"Well, Lord Ashton, sir, I'll tell you a tale, if you don't mind. When I was a wee girl, my father was the master of hounds from a small estate. Have extra patience with the naughty pups, Elsinore, he always said. It's the wildest one in the litter who'll be leader of the pack some day. Blast! I like that answer.
Lord Frederick chewed his cigar.
Elsinore, that's in Denmark, what?
The capital of Denmark is Copenhagen,
Beowulf interjected, pleased that he remembered.
I wouldn't know, I'm sure, Mrs. Penworthy demurred. I do enjoy a good Danish pastry, though.
As any globe could tell you, Denmark is the southernmost country of the northernmost nations of Europe. North of Copenhagen is the city of Elsinore, home to the castle where Hamlet takes place, with its wandering ghosts, ill-advised eavesdropping behind the drapes, conversations with skulls and deadly jewels in iambic pentameter. No wonder the play is considered a masterpiece. Imagine how much more enjoyable it would be when viewed with a Danish pastry in one hand and restorative cup of tea in the other.
Master of hounds! Danish pastries? I see nothing wrong here.
Lord Frederick turned to the incorrigibles.
All right, give me the bad news. What's the problem this time?
All three children shook their heads.
What? Nothing? Nothing at all?
Cassiopeia tugged at his sleeve.
She's perfect, Lord Uru.
Perfect? Well, whoa!
He glanced at his pocket watch.
How many other applicants are left out there?
Millions. Enough to keep us here past supper time.
Beowulf said, rubbing his tummy forlornly.
Millions is hyperbole,
his sister warned, though she too was getting hungry.
I estimate 212,
Alexandra announced after a brief mental calculation.
At 8 minutes per interview, that would mean...
He scribbled furiously with his pencil to find exactly how many baby nurse interviews would fit into one afternoon, otherwise known as the afternoon-slash-baby-nurse problem.
200? Blast!
Lord Frederick stood and walked the length of the room.
I've no patience for all that helloing and chit-chat about diapers. The baby's on his way and there's no time to waste. Incorrigibles, come!
It sounded like he was calling his dogs, but the children bounded over, following him to the far side of the parlour. He crouched to their level and spoke quietly.
What say you, my wolfish wards? Will Mrs. Penworthy do or not? If she's perfect, we're unlikely to find better, what?
I vote yes, said Alexander. I vote yes, too, said Beowulf.
I vote yes, times two, said Cassiopeia. Double yes!
It's settled, then.
Lord Frederick strode back across the parlour.
Congratulations, Penworthy. You've got the job.
Mrs. Elsinore Incognito Penworthy gave a satisfied smile and adjusted her, that is to say, his, wig. There had been no ladies' shoes in all of Ashton Place into which Simon could cram his generously sized feet. Luckily, the flounce of pink tulle, as you may have guessed, it had briefly served as a tutu before being hastily attached to the bottom of one of Mrs. Clark's old dresses, added just enough length to keep Simon's boots concealed, as he, that is to say, she, stood tall and gave Lord Frederick's hand a vigorous shake.
Well, the lady crooned with a wink that only the children could see, that's just ducky, your lordship, sir.
Lord Frederick gazed up at his new employee, a half-head taller than himself.
Incorrigibles, tell Mrs. Clark to send the rest of the applicants away. We've found our baby nurse, by gum.
The 8th chapter. Penelope makes a daring escape. Back at the barracks, the Babushkinov twins lost no time in trying to upset Veronica with tales of all she had missed during their walk.
We saw a giant sailing ship that flew in the sky, they boasted. We rode in it ourselves. We sailed to Moscow and back within an hour.
Elias,
the girl said, gazing serenely into the distance. By means of bribery and persuasion and threats, Madame Babushkinov had finally convinced her to stop acting like a coward and get out of bed. Now the child stood pale-faced and determined, practicing her pliés, one hand resting on the iron bedframe and the other arm swooped through the air as she squatted and rose over and over again.
Lay an egg! Lay an egg! Lay an egg!
Her brothers teased as they watched her sink low, knees akimbo. Veronica completed her descent.
Mama does not love you,
she answered on her way up. When she reached her tiptoes, she added,
Neither does Papa. They wish you have never been born.
The boy's lips trembled, and Veronica flung her arms skyward in smug satisfaction. Their parents were not there to scold them, not that they would have in any case. The captain had gone out for a career-advancing luncheon with some officers he had met. Madame Babushkinov was off attending to her toilet, with a guard stationed outside the bath to ensure her complete privacy. Penelope sat within earshot of the children's antics, but she scarcely heard them, for she was deep in thought. She was thinking, no, not about the incorrigibles, or Simon, or the Karublik, or even what to have for lunch, but about the thrilling novel she had once read called The Count of Monte Cristo by Alexandre Dumas. Monsieur Dumas was French, but Penelope had read the book in English, for it was extremely popular and had been translated into many languages. Monsieur Dumas wrote another equally popular book called The Three Musketeers, although there are more than three musketeers in it. Exactly how many musketeers go into The Three Musketeers, you may think of it as the musketeer-slash-musketeer problem, is well worth investigating. But not just now, for Penelope's mind is occupied with The Count of Monte Cristo, and for good reason, too. In a nutshell, The Count of Monte Cristo is the tale of a young sailor named Edmond Dantès. He is falsely accused of treason and sentenced to the dreaded Château d'If, a prison located on a small island in the Mediterranean Sea. Dantès endures 14 desperate years on that cursed isle, waiting for a window of opportunity to escape. When another prisoner dies, he switches places with the dead body and is buried at sea, after which he swims to freedom and is rescued by friendly smugglers. He travels incognito and assumes one disguise after another. Eventually, he acquires a large fortune and reappears in society as the mysterious Count of Monte Cristo. The rest of the book is devoted to the Count's cruel and complex schemes of revenge against those who had falsely accused him in the first place, all of whom end up ruined or dead. Thus the tale ends as so many tales do, happily for some and miserably for others. Edmond Dantès's daring break from an island prison is considered one of the greatest escapes in all of literature to this very day. Penelope had no interest in revenge, but as a person in the midst of a daring escape herself, the Count of Monte Cristo offered food for thought. Just as Edmond Dantès had tricked his captors by pretending to be a dead body, she had tricked the Babushkinovs into bringing her to St. Petersburg. But now came the more difficult part of her journey, for to get back to England required passage on a ship. "I would gladly hitch a ride with friendly smugglers, as Edmond Dantès did," she thought. "But that business about being buried at sea sounds frightfully cold, and I am not much of a swimmer in any case. My heavens, what is that dreadful row?" It was Madame Babushkinov. After her toilet, the proud madame had gone to the common room and imperiously demanded on a lowly soldier that he go and procure buttered rolls and fresh coffee for her and the children. His answer must have displeased her, for her voice cut through the barracks like a siren.
"Gosh, for the commissary, are you mad? I asked for rolls and coffee, not a duel-encrusted egg. Don't you know who we are? We are the Babushkinovs. Our name is all the credit we need."
It was not long before the scent of fresh rolls and hot coffee filled the air. Penelope listened and pondered. She thought of the Count of Monte Cristo and of that other young sailor and master of disguise, Simon Harley Dickinson. She thought of Lady Constance Ashton and her seamstress, Madame Lepont, who could fashion a new gown in a day. Piece by piece, stitch by stitch, a plan took shape in her mind.
All I need, she thought, is a window of opportunity.
By mid-afternoon, Veronica had plied to the point of exhaustion. She no longer complained of nerves. In fact, she seemed numb of all feeling, except a kind of stone-faced endurance, like a prisoner waiting to be called to the gallows. Any joy she had once taken in dancing had left her, as had her grandiose dreams of being, at 12 years old, the youngest prima ballerina in the history of ballet. Now she simply wanted the ordeal to end. Cranky, hungry, and bone-tired, she demanded to go to her audition at once and get the whole dreadful business over with. However, the captain had still not returned from his officer's luncheon, and Madame Babushkinov refused to go anywhere in this strange city without him. Now she was the one overcome with nerves. Veronica's shrill, repeated demand that they leave
right now, Mama, right now,
had given her a blinding headache, or so Madame claimed. For the past hour, she had been lying on her cot.
Agony, she whimpered again and again. Agony, agony.
Penelope offered to go out for ice, a bottle of aspirin, a doctor, anything at all, but Madame insisted that Penelope not leave her side.
Where is my husband? She moaned.
Madame, I will look for him, Penelope volunteered. I will check every cafe and gentlemen's club in St. Petersburg. Of course, that could take hours.
As you see, Penelope was desperately seeking her window of opportunity. All she needed was an excuse to go out and stay out. How hard could it be?
Yes, Madame said weakly. All right.
Penelope was on her feet in a flash.
I mean, no, don't leave me, Miss Lumley. What if I died right here in this horrible barracks, and Ivan was run over by an omnibus, or killed in a duel? Heaven forbid! Who would care for the children then?
Madame closed her eyes and thrashed as if she were at death's door.
Oh, Maximilian, my precious baby Max. Now I will never see his sweet round face again. Those chubby hands, those dimpled cheeks.
Exhausted by her own suffering, she began to snore. In despair, Veronica resumed practicing, though by now her legs were like noodles. The twins were horribly jealous to hear baby Max praised by their mother, and decided to misbehave out of spite. Already they had discovered that the mattresses on their cots were filled with feathers, and they were plucking them out through the mattress ticking, one by one. Penelope took deep, calming breaths, as she had been taught to do at school.
If Edmond Dantès could wait 14 years in a cold, dark prison, she told herself, surely I can hold steady until the captain returns. After all, how long can one luncheon last?
But the missing pater of the Babushka Woos did not reappear till evening. It was still light out, for St. Petersburg is so far north on the globe that on the longest days of the year the sun sets only briefly and it never gets dark at all. These are called the White Nights, and they happen in late June and early July, but even in April the sun did not set until 8 o'clock, and twilight lasted well past that hour. Navigators, take note. St. Petersburg is at 60 degrees north latitude. That is as far north as the lower parts of Alaska, or the Shetland Islands of Scotland, birthplace of the famously brave and rugged Shetland ponies. However, talk of ponies is best saved for later, for Captain Babushkinov has returned, and he seems to be at a rather high latitude himself. Yes, the captain was back, and very merry, and had a funny medicinal smell about him. He had spent the afternoon gambling, he said, playing cards with the officers. He had lost a great deal of money. It was all to the good. Madame Babushkinov was propped in a chair, a blanket across her lap. Her impatience had long since turned to fury.
"Whose money, Ivan?"
she asked in a voice like shattering glass. "Exactly whose money did you lose?"
"Never mind, never mind,"
he kissed her sloppily on one cheek.
"It is men's business, and nothing for you to worry about."
"There is your business,"
Madame pointed at Veronica, as if accusing the girl of a crime.
"What about her, you fool? She is here to audition for the Tsar's own ballet, and you spend the day losing borrowed money at cards."
"I don't even want to do it anymore,"
the girl whined.
"She can't dance anyway. He-he-he,"
the boys said, tickling each other with the feathers.
"Silence,"
the captain roared. He looked at Penelope.
"You, yes, you, governess, come here."
Penelope did so. He lowered his deep bass voice, but it was like trying to play softly on a tuba.
"Today I had luck," he said, "but it was all bad luck. I owe a great deal of money to one of the generals. My signature was not enough for him. Fool, coward. But never mind, never mind. It is the way the world is."
He wobbled and seated himself on the edge of the nearest cot.
"I must send him a pledge against my debt by midnight tonight. Ugh, what have I done?"
Groaning, he smacked the tops of his thighs repeatedly. This seemed to calm him, and he looked up at Penelope, a shaggy black dog with bloodshot eyes.
"Governess, I need you to bring a small item of great value to the general's house. Can you do that?"
Penelope wanted to skip circles in joy, but she forced herself to speak calmly.
"Of course, Captain. I will go at once."
He swiveled his massive head toward his wife. Madame Babushkinov's lap blanket slipped unnoticed to the floor as she writhed in her chair.
"Oh, no, you don't, Ivan. No! I will win it back, my darling. Tomorrow, you'll see, my luck will change.
No, no, no!"
she raged, even as she wrenched the princess's ring off her finger and all but threw it at Penelope.
"Fine, here it is. Take it, take it. See if I care.
Ivan, you can explain to your mother how you lost her precious emerald at cards."
Fortune favors the bold, as the saying goes, but it also favors the patient and prepared, and Penelope was surely that. Here was her chance. On her way out, she stopped in the common room to retrieve her carpet bag, which she had earlier hidden beneath the curtained table that held the samovar. In her pocket was a letter from the Imperial Ballet. Once the Babushkinovs realized the letter was fake and that their governess had run off, it would not take long to put Duva and Duva together, so to speak. The letter was evidence. Later, she would burn it. Meanwhile, she left a note of her own, saying that after her errand was complete, she would spend the night at the St. Petersburg home for poor, bright governesses, as she feared it would be too late to return to the barracks alone. Tolstoy was nowhere to be seen, and she was sorry not to have another chance to speak with the interesting young officer. "But he is a writer, after all," she thought, as she walked quickly, but not too quickly, to the door. "One day I might discover a book of his in a bookshop and read it, and that will be very like seeing him again. And who knows? They say writers sometimes base their characters on people they have met. Perhaps there will be some mention of me in his stories." The thought of being turned into a fictional character amused her. How absurd it would feel! A moment later, she was on the street, through the window of opportunity at last. "Adieu, Babushkinovs," she thought. Walking briskly, the carpet bag swinging jauntily at her side.
"Arrivederci, and farewell. But I will not say da svidaniye, because I have no expectation of seeing you later, or ever again."
Was it bittersweet for Penelope to part from the horrible babushka woos so abruptly, without so much as a goodbye? They had been her students, after all. Did she feel even a tiny tug at her heart to leave these three vile children behind? In a word, no. She had been a prisoner in their house, just as Edmond Dantès
was at the Chateau d'Yves. The Babushkinovs had treated her badly and were not one bit sorry about it. She wished them no harm, for that was not her way, but nor did she feel obliged to concern herself with the fate of that unhappy, unpleasant, and unrepentant family. A Swanburn girl may forgive as she chooses, but she is no pushover either, she told herself, and felt rather pleased about it too. But blast, what to do about this emerald ring, which could easily pay for her voyage home 100 times over? She waited to examine it until she was 10 blocks from the barracks. Then she could not help herself. She paused in a doorway to retrieve it from her pocket and hold it up to the light. The rectangular stone was the size of a domino, set in a thick gold band with delicate swirling patterns engraved on each side. If fire could be green, this was the green it would be, a glow from within and leaping to catch the light. She returned the gem to her pocket and resumed walking. The ring is lovely and no doubt priceless, but I will not steal it, and not only because it would be wrong to do so, she decided. The stone and setting are much too distinctive not to raise suspicion. If I tried to sell it, the police would be called at once. Still, I see no harm in borrowing it for a short while. The captain said the general must have it by midnight, which gives me plenty of time. She turned the corner of Nevsky Prospect and walked toward Theatre Square. There it was, the Bolshoi Camille Theatre, home of the Imperial Russian Ballet. Penelope had long dreamed of visiting the ballet and knew all about it. For example, she knew that Bolshoi meant big and Camille meant stone. It had been named the Big Stone Theatre to avoid getting mixed up with a small wooden theatre that stood nearby. A big stone, just like the emerald in my pocket. I shall take that as a good sign, she thought. Yet, as Agatha Swanburn once cautioned, a plan is like a bed, made in the morning, unmade at night. I must be prepared for whatever happens. A well-dressed crowd began to gather in front of the Bolshoi Camille, but she avoided the main entrance and instead made her way to the alley that ran alongside the building. Thank goodness Simon had taught her how theatres work. Here she found the stage door, where the dancers and musicians and stagehands went in and out. She paused for a moment to prepare. Her Russian would not get her far, but people in the ballet world all spoke French. Admittedly, some time had passed since she had taken French at Swanburn, but how hard could it be to recall a few simple phrases? Bonjour means good day, she reminded herself. Merci beaucoup means thank you very much. And fromage is cheese, which might come in useful if I am offered a snack. The rest would come back as needed, she felt quite sure. She knocked and waited. Moments later, the stage door opened. A man stood there, already impatient. He had the straight spine of a dancer, but wore ordinary clothes and a tool belt, and his close-cropped beard was shot with grey. He did not seem particularly friendly, but perhaps he was just busy. A stage manager, just what I need, Penelope thought, for Simon had described the type very well. A good stage manager is swift and efficient as a London postal worker, and I have no time to waste. She took a deep breath and began, en français. Good day, mister. I here arrive in look of job. If you please, she smiled broadly. I apologize. Big, very big. My French is old. He lifted an eyebrow at her, odd phrasing, and answered in rapid-fire French that she could barely follow.
We are no openings in the corps de ballet, mademoiselle, or among the principal dancers either, unless you are a prima ballerina absoluta, which, no offense, I think you are not.
He gave her an appraising look.
Although your posture is not bad, much better than your French. Goodbye.
She wedged her carpet bag in the doorway. Wait, 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 she blurted. The job I look is sewing. Costumes, she added, remembering that the French word for costume was, in fact, costume.
Ah, costumes. That's another matter.
He glanced over his shoulder.
The wardrobe mistress always needs help. People scarcely know how to sew on a button anymore, it seems. And they call that progress. Come inside and wait. I'll see if she's busy.
Merci, merci beaucoup, Penelope exclaimed, but he was already gone. She was not entirely sure what the man had said, but it sounded like he was coming back. He had used the word bouton, too. This was another good sign, for she was an excellent button sewer, thanks to a class at Swanburn devoted to that very skill. And look where she was. She wondered, and the wondering made her woozy with hope, whether there was a performance scheduled for that night. The people waiting out front had been nattily dressed after all. A moment later, the stage manager returned.
Mademoiselle, you're in luck. The wardrobe mistress is in a frenzy, mending the costumes for tonight's performance, for they are delicate. If you can so much as hold a needle, you will be put to work at once. Follow me, he sniffed. I hope you like feathers.
Backstage at the Bolshoi Camille, it was like being inside an enormous beehive, with a constant buzz and people scurrying everywhere. Costumers, stagehands, musicians, the choreographer and his many assistants. Penelope wanted to stop and soak up every detail, but the stage manager glided across the stage at a quick floating trot. It was the noiseless gait of someone who had spent long years moving silently in the dark so as not to disturb the performance. And there were the ballerinas, warming up. Their hair was slicked back into tight buns that sat high upon their heads, the better to emphasize their extra-long necks. Stage makeup made their eyes look enormous, and their long, knobbly-kneed legs disappeared into wide, feathered tutus that bounced comically when they moved. It was as if a whole flock of Berthas had been set loose backstage. But these were not flightless birds. On the contrary, they jumped and soared as if the laws of physics did not apply at all.
Mademoiselle.
The tap on her shoulder was sharp, the voice pointed. Penelope turned. With a wave of his hand and a few whispered words, the stage manager handed off to the wardrobe mistress. This lady also wore her hair in a bun, but hers was pure silver. Her gaze was direct, but not unkind. She had the uncompromising look of a former dancer. Or a Latin teacher at Swanburn, Penelope thought, suppressing a smile.
You are here to work?
The woman said in slow, deliberate French. She mimed the act of sewing. It seemed she had been warned that Penelope was not fluent. Yes, thank you. Penelope followed her to the far side of the stage, which was concealed from the audience by rows of heavy curtains. These must be the wings, she said, remembering what Simon had told her about the world backstage. No. The woman scooped an armful of tutus from a bin and dumped them in Penelope's arms.
Not the wings. The feathers.
It was true. All of the tutus were covered with feathers. Apparently, the evening's ballet was bird-themed, and there were dozens of these fragile tutus on hand. With a brief demonstration, the wardrobe mistress showed Penelope how to stitch fresh feathers to the bare spots. It was simple, if ticklish work, and Penelope mastered it quickly. The wardrobe mistress was soon satisfied and left her to carry on unsupervised, for the performance would begin in less than an hour, and she had a long to-do list to attend to. Penelope worked quietly, waiting. When she was certain no one was near, she put down her sewing and examined the rest of the costumes, which were hung on large garment racks by the wall and stored in labelled boxes. There were fancy dresses made of silk and velvet and chiffon, men's breeches and brocade vests, miles of taffeta and endless lengths of ribbon, and countless boxes of tiaras and leather slippers.
What lavish costumes, she thought. One could hardly fashion a disguise for a scullery maid or a stowaway out of these elegant fabrics. But for my purposes, they ought to do quite well.
She made her selections, and soon she was back at work.
Places, places, please,
the stage manager called. Moments later, cued by a downward strike of the conductor's baton, the music swelled and filled the theatre. Like sailors hoisting a mighty sail, burly stagehands hauled thick ropes hand over hand to roll back the stage curtain, and the performance began. For those in the audience, it was as if normal time had stopped,
as they were transported by the seemingly effortless wonder of it all. For those putting on the show, it was a different matter altogether. For 3 long hours, the orchestra played, the dancers danced, and Penelope sewed as if her life depended on it. Who could have foretold that all those years of stitching pithy wise sayings onto pillows would prove so useful? When anyone came near, she mended tutus. The rest of the time, she busied herself sewing a different sort of costume. She had found most of what she needed on the garment racks, but she wanted a heavier fabric to make a warm cloak. Luckily, she found a large quantity of attractive red velvet hanging at the edge of the stage. "In for a kopeck, in for a rouble," she told herself as she sliced away at it with a pair of scissors. That is what Agatha Swanburn would say if she were here and familiar with Russian currency. If I intend to accomplish my goal, which I do, I must dive all the way into the pool, so to speak, and not tiptoe around the edge. As she worked, she snuck awestruck glances at the stage. The Imperial Russian Ballet laid out before her like a picnic. For years she had dreamed of seeing them perform, and naturally she had always imagined herself seated in the theatre, like everyone else. But there was something magical about watching the dancers from backstage, the way they transformed into such airy, weightless beings while dancing. When offstage they were all earthbound muscle and sweaty concentration. Truly, it was a marvel. As for the ballet itself, she was too distracted by her sewing to follow the story closely, but it involved a great many ballerinas dressed as birds doing complicated dance steps. "It rather puts me in mind of Dr. Westminster and his dancing chickens," Penelope thought as she snipped a loose thread with her teeth. The Swanburn veterinarian had a real knack for animal training and had once succeeded in teaching chickens to dance. To be fair, the chickens deserved most of the credit. "But these dancers are far more nimble than chickens, and better flyers, too," she decided. "No wonder their tutus are in constant need of mending." Penelope sewed and stole glances at the stage, and part of her wished it would never end, but at last the ballet was over. Now all eyes turned to the footlights as each dancer came forward to take a bow and bask in the applause. This was her chance. Quickly, she hid behind a garment rack and slipped on the outfit she had fashioned. Her own plain dress she left behind on the rack, on the off chance there might one day be a ballet about governesses. It was unlikely, perhaps, but surely not impossible. One glance in the backstage mirror confirmed that she was unrecognizable. "A great many costumes went into this one costume," she thought, pleased with both her disguise and the potential math lesson. But there was no time to solve the costume/costumes problem just now. For the finishing touch, she placed the princess's emerald ring on her finger. She grabbed her carpet bag, which she had bedecked with feathers to make it more elegant, and slipped through a door that led to the auditorium. The audience roared and clapped, and she made her way in the darkness to the back of the theatre. There she blended in perfectly with the wealthy patrons of the ballet. She applauded with vigour and shouted, "Brava! Brava!" just like everyone else. The prima ballerina was the last to come out, and received twice the applause of everyone else. Her admirers rushed the stage and handed her one bouquet after another, until her arms could barely hold all the flowers. As she bowed low, first to one side of the audience, then to the other, the great red velvet stage curtain closed majestically behind her. There was a rather large hole at the far end of the curtain that had not been there at the evening's start. "Whoops, I had best be on my way." Penelope tugged at the red velvet cape she now wore and drew it close round her shoulders as she made a hasty beeline for the exit. It was a pity about the stage curtain, but really, what choice had she had? The weather was brisk, and she could hardly go traipsing around St. Petersburg without a wrap. "Anyway, a bit of fabric is fair payment for my work on the tutus," she thought, "for I did sew on quite a few feathers." If there was one thing Penelope had learned from Madame Babushkinov, it was this. People are often judged by their clothing in the same way that a book is judged by its cover. And if there were two things Penelope had learned from Madame Babushkinov, the other one was this.
When powerful-seeming people behave badly and demand to be waited upon and obeyed, very often they will get their way. For it is a rare, brave soul who will stand up to a figure of authority in high dungeon, a fact that Penelope now hoped to take advantage of. To that end, the costume she had fashioned was designed not for warmth or comfort, but solely to impress. The gold satin shirt was wrapped